Good to have you here.
Pretty much the Great White North this summer. So, and I was also interested, of course, in glucosinolates because I did my PhD in canola breeding and did literally thousands and thousands of glucosinolate analyses back in the day. So I'm here to talk about an old research center that's been given a new life. Let's say the phoenix rising from the ashes of the old Vineland Research Station. And so partly when I do this talk, I have to talk about the history of the place. And of course, it's steeped in the history of agriculture innovation in Canada, which is in many ways not different than it is in the U.S. It started in Canada with a piece of legislation called the Farm Stations Act of 1886. And that was what created was basically a real estate deal that put a research center in every province and a set of research objectives around seed quality and cheese, things like that. And that was back in 1886, and if you're into legislation, that all of most people aren't, that legislation is unchanged today. So that what the policy guidance for our innovation system is over 100 years old, and quite frankly, you know, things have changed. So that old system was designed with what would be we call the pioneers, you might call them settlers, but these were people that came to the country that either weren't farmers, didn't speak the language, and quite frankly needed their hands held so that they could live through the winter. Okay, so now it's all of a sudden it's 2012 or 13, 14, and you have your local greenhouse vegetable producer, let's say Pete Quiring from Nature Fresh, who's got $110 million invested in just in the capital side of his operation. And you go, well, I don't know necessarily if I know more than he does about what he should do, right? Maybe we've got to listen more. So this is kind of the story of that. And so the Vineland Research Innovation Center was founded in 1906. There was a fellow named Moses Rittenhouse. He was an A Moses, not the Moses, right? And he'd moved from Canada to Chicago, and then when the city had burned down, he made a very large fortune selling lumber to build the city back up again, and then he came back to the community and gave all his money away. And part of what he did was he built the road and the school and the library, but he also deeded this property and one building to the province of Ontario for the purpose of horticulture research, right? Because he thought it was going to be important for the future of the province, and that we needed innovation and all of that stuff, and as it turned out to be true. And the station was a center point for the growth of the horticulture industry in Ontario for many decades past that. Up to, let's say, the mid-80s, things started to change. There was a shift in provincial government and quite a strident shift in ideology, at least for we Canadians who don't shift very far to the right or left, right? It's hard to tell. It's mostly in the middle, right? So, but these guys were very far to the right, and while they valued innovation a lot, they didn't feel that they should be doing it. So they said, well, look, you know, we're happy to steer, but we're not going to paddle any longer. And this station, along with, I think, 13 others, the whole management structure and everything was changed. The scientific staff woke up one morning and they were all tenured professors, which comes with its own responsibility in an unusual transition because they were all given automatic tenured positions, and then the university was contracted back to operate the facilities and then contracted to conduct research and given about half the money they needed to do that. And so it worked variously well depending on which station you were at, and in this particular one it didn't work at all. And by 2007, the facility was probably half abandoned. Buildings had burned and boarded up. Services turned off. There was a few staff left. There was generally a very positive attitude about the future. And as governments do, they thought, well, you know, boy, we're going to have to do something. And they didn't want to decide, so they pushed it back out to the community to say, well, what should we do? And the panel was put together, and the outcome of that was, well, you know, innovation is critical in agriculture. We can't not do it. But it needs to change. It needs a new model. And from that, it was a not-for-profit was created in order to build a future for the place, right? And it's interesting in Canada, of course, because when there's a level of public investment here and a level of need here, we fill those with not-for-profits. We have 163,000 not-for-profits in the country. They do everything. You know, there are minor soccer association, there's the Canadian Diabetes Association, there's the Canadian Heart Council, the Canadian Nursery Land, you know, all of those kinds of organizations. And that's how we do this. Okay? So that's what Vineland became. And then, you know, my background, well, you know, I'm a plant breeder by trade, become molecular biologist later in life, and I was a bench scientist with the federal government who, you know, like many of us, sat around the coffee room complaining about the system that we worked in. And then one day the phone rang, and one of those upper tier people that I always complained to said, well, you know, here's your chance. You can put up or shut up, right? Why don't you quit and come in and rebuild this place? And so that's how it started. And while it was clear that there was something wrong, it wasn't clear what exactly it was. So as a scientist, and if many of you are, my instant instinct was, if you give me $25 million, I'm going to spend it on myself, right? Because what I'm doing is the most important thing in the world. And really, it turns out to be the case. In this case, you had to take some time to understand what was wrong. Why was the place not working anymore? What had happened? And there was a series of things that had gone wrong, including you know, it became academic and people became judged on academic criteria, and that's not really because agriculture research is an economic development activity necessarily. That's what it's supposed to do. And so you kind of lost sight of the end point. Things were moving, our industries were globalizing, and the pace of research was too slow you need a new variety every 3 years, not every 15. And if you need it every 3, then you've got to have it every 3, and otherwise your programs become irrelevant. And there was even a change in the social fabric, and I'm not that I'm very knowledgeable in this, but the social fabric of the research stations was completely different. They used to be rural. People lived on those stations. They were part of the community. And there was an ongoing, constant conversation about what you try to build in an incubator is to get people together. And that just happened naturally. But over time, that ended. Like, our rural research station, it's not that rural. When there's 205,000 cars a day go by my office, right, on 6 lanes of the Queen Elizabeth Way. And it's surrounded by urban landscape. Toronto is just across the lake, Hamilton on and on and on, all the way to the border at Niagara Falls. And so people aren't part of the community. They commute in from elsewhere. And so even that conversation had been lost. And so you needed to rebuild it in a way that captured the needs of those things without trying to rebuild the old system, because there was no way that was going to happen. We are not going to have 1,200 provincial extension agents anymore. There isn't money in the system to do it. And we got to find a new way to A, do relevant research, and B, deliver results, right? So that's what this story is about. And in part, where is that? I think, so my story is really about the future, but it's hard to talk about the future without talking a little bit about the past. And so the story here is this, that 10,000 years ago, agriculture itself was an innovation, right? And it's been disruptive cycles in innovation in agriculture that have allowed us to feed ourselves. Okay? So every time, you know, and you think even of the age of abundance, if you think about dwarf wheat and rice and how many billion people that feeds, and it makes you think, okay, so for us, innovation in agriculture is even more important than its economic impact. It's really what sustains our species. Every time we have a big jump in population, it's major innovation in agriculture that allows us to sustain that population. So it's a critical thing to get right. So languishing in old models that are ineffective is very sentimental and all of that, but I don't think as a society and as a civilization we can afford to get this wrong. And so it's important to explore new ways despite the pressures of the old ways, that we need to look at new ways to do things. And so that's what Vineland is about. And the core, so what really are we? You know, and it's kind of a long statement. We're a results-based, independent, not-for-profit organization focused on horticulture. So our results are something meaningful and real. So we measure ourselves
in acres and fields and shelf space in the store. So that project may start way, way upstream, right? It can be reverse genetics. You know, you're mutating genes involved in you know, controlling systemic acquired resistance, for example. But you want to see all the way to the end point, and you want to have a plan to get there, so that you know that there's going to be impact at the end, and that makes a huge difference. Our horticulture includes the whole value chain. Again, the old relationship in agriculture science with me and a producer, and often fail to recognize that there's consumers out the other end, there's retailers, there's distribution, and yet everybody's boat's got to float along that pathway, or your innovation goes nowhere. Absolutely, and you know, the journals are filled with stories like that, where things just get stuck on the library shelf, and because there hasn't been that thought. We're a not-for-profit, and not-for-profit, as I told you, is a very important thing that brings stakeholder focus. So we're not an educational organization. We are not a political organization. We're really only there for one reason, and that's to support the horticulture industry in Canada. And on the final element, which is scary sometimes, we're a completely independent organization. So government nor the universities, neither director nor member of this corporation. We get a lot of government money. We get contracted to do work, just like a lot of organizations do. But we have a policy-driven business board. And so that also allows you to keep your focus on that endpoint result. So what was the big deal? So in 2007, when I started, they'd been this panel of wise people who'd gone around, and one of the conclusions was kind of this, that private sector research was right, and public sector research was wrong. And then as the new CEO, my job was to make the right choice, which was fairly obvious, right? Well, you know, as I looked at it, I thought, well, you know, that's actually a false choice. Because the private sector commercializes research really well, and the public sector does research really well. And why not, in creating a new organization, in a way to resolve the tension between those models, is you just take the best things out of both and put them together in one. And really, the research part of that is easy. It's the real commitment to commercialization. But you see, in many academic organizations, they all have a commercialization arm. So for 3,000 professors, you have a business office with one person in it. And it's so true. And it takes 8 months to get an agreement through it, or sometimes way longer than that. And it isn't real. It's window dressing in an effort to garner grant money. So what we try to do is again, all the way from the board, all the way through, say, well, we're going to use business tools, because really we aren't. You know, we don't manufacture anything. We're not a seed company. We're not a nursery. We're none of those things. And that we need that business arrangements, business deals, and business partners in order to do this, right? So that was how we resolved that, and that was sort of the fundament of the model, to say, well, okay, here's how we're going to operate. The other key piece of this is partnerships, right? So everybody's talked about partnerships, but partnerships are absolutely key. So Vineland, at Vineland, we don't do anything alone. We're always working with somebody. And if you think about innovation as a pipeline, and you want to be able to see from one end of that pipe out to the other end, that the partners are critical. They bring aperture. So they need to be chosen not for expediency, but for strategic reasons. They need to be the right partner, the right size, with the right marketing channels in order to get those things out. And they need to be open to it. So it's another thing you learn about partners, is not every organization, not every university, and not every government agency is really open to it. Some folks just aren't, right? They may operate in a very kind of inward-looking way. You can think of a lot of companies are very secretive in the way they operate. So it's very difficult to work with them in this kind of model, but nonetheless, incredibly important. And this is kind of a dynamic set of slides that changes as projects change, right? Because we're a project-based organization, not program-based. And that means we get in and out of things as time permits. And you know, when I look at it, you look at, there's organizations like the Ontario College of Art and Design, and you think, wow, oh my God, what's with that? Well, you know, it's horticulture, so you got to think that through, right? So it's the fashion business. At the end of the day, it's got to look good, doesn't it? Like, nobody cares what their soybeans look like, really. I don't mean that in an insulting way, but they don't, right? They don't even know, most people don't even know what a soybean looks like. But they know what that flower is supposed to look like, and they know what that peach is supposed to look like, and they want that to be connected with their positive kind of hedonic experience. And so what OCAD brings is they don't know what's impossible in agriculture. It's true. So, you know, and so, and in this particular case, it was creating a new nursery plant called a pixie grape. And so in our nursery business, or in our greenhouse flower business, is where this ended up. It's a business dominated by men, 10% of whom are colorblind, right? They're making the choices of what colors are going to go out next year. Are they that good at it? I think there's a huge constraint there, and so then going to these OCAD people, and it was mostly students, they can just come up with ideas that you can't even imagine, and some of them are never going to work. You just can't grow it upside down or that kind of thing, but at the end of the day, we came up with some really great prototypes of what that plant could look like, and then you can use your consumer science tools to really figure out which ones are going to be best and what people will pay for it. So partners bring a lot to the table, and you need to be very open-minded about it. They're also going to help you get to places faster at a time when you need to be fast. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. So everything, you know, I just got a few project examples after this, but this is the underlying model, right? And every project in every program that we have has to conform as best it can to this particular model. So the first part of it is this, that you need a validated consumer or customer concept. It has to be something that you can actually demonstrate that someone wants, and they want enough of it that you can actually make some money doing it. Because you can do really cool things and sell 2 units, right? And go, well, that was really cool. It cost us $1 million to do it, and we made $400. So you don't want to do that. And I mean, scientists aren't necessarily that good at this yet. I mean, our guys are getting better and better all the time because of this process, but we have the support functions at the front end to say, well, is there enough customers? Is it big enough? Is. You need good science, great science, and, you know, instinctively, we're reasonably good at that, right? We know who to collaborate with, who's got the equipment, where they might be, and you need to work at that, and we can recognize a good proposal from a bad proposal, and that kind of thing. And then the third key piece is, again, commercial partnerships, and have those built in at the beginning of the project. So the typical process is that I go off and invent something, I come to the commercialization office, and I go, sell it for me. And you go out there, and the industry guys go, do you have that in blue? Well, of course not, right? Because nobody talked to me beforehand. It's always afterwards. And what that does is it slows innovation. You get into that stop and go mode, right? And there you go. That takes time. You got to go back to the lab and actually do what people want. So if you ask them first, it's a lot easier. It doesn't mean you're going to have a success, but your probability of success goes way up. And the speed with which that innovation is going to move into the marketplace, it's going to go way up, right? So engage at the beginning. Anyway, just a few programs. So for us, interesting, when I got to the station, what I did realize, you know, and I was a field agriculture person, right? So canola and wheat, that kind of thing. And, you know, consumers weren't part of the deal. And he had somebody working on bread making quality and all that, but they were very distant from the actual work. But in horticulture, it was incredibly important. So at the beginning, started this consumer science group. So that's two pieces. That's sensory stuff, right? In an effort to try to connect what people like with a bit of biochemistry and a bit of genetics, right? So that you can actually build things that they want, will buy. I think you need to understand markets as well. What's going on out there? What is this demographic like versus that demographic? Can you segment? There is a lot of work done that way in fresh produce. You know, how many peach segments are there, right? There's at least 2 There's at least two apple segments too, right? There's fresh red apple, fresh green apple, and then another 20% of people who don't care. But you need to understand that when you're breeding apples to be able to slot things into the right spot. So consumers are good, and the other thing about innovation is innovation happens at these intersection points between disparate disciplines. And it's interesting to blend social science with biological science. You get a whole lot of new ideas and new ways, and so the consumer group underpins all of our projects, say robots, which there isn't a big direct consumer piece there. So this is robot. So in Canada, and I don't imagine it's much different here in the U.S., but the single biggest issue in horticulture is really cost of goods, and the single biggest element of cost of goods is labor. And that's between 40 and 60% of anything that we grow is the cost of labor. In fact, the cost of labor is 2 times higher than the cumulative profitability of the whole sector. So you're a business guy, you get it, you go, geez, we ought to look at that. Well, so really all that's happened in our industry is there's been a lobby effort to keep wages for agricultural workers low and create programs, immigration programs, to bring people over the border when we need them to do that work. And then you guys wouldn't know, but us Canadians know, those programs are under a lot of pressure because they've been abused to death. And so now what do? We do what the rest of agriculture did back in 1880, and they mechanized and automated. And so that's what this program is all about, creating automation systems for horticulture. And again, you know, the technology didn't exist 100 years ago, but it does now in articulated six-axis robots and software and vision systems that allow you to do a lot of those functions that require a lot of tactile skills, right? And six-axis robots are $38,000. They're a commodity. You can buy them on the internet. Teaching them what to do, that's a skill, right? But I think this is a shift you're going to see. And that machine there that does, that robot there that packages mini roses and calancho and tulips and all the rest of it, it puts the mylar, the stribbin, the sticker, and puts it in the sleeve. That machine pays back in about 2 years and will put $185,000 a year in your pocket, displacing 6 people, and it runs 2 hours a day when you need 2 hours a day, and it runs 24 hours a day when you need 24 hours. And you know, there's Mother's Day and then there's not. And that's the kind of versatility. And when you're not using it, you can stick it on a truck and send it down to the neighbors
if you want. So it's those kinds of things that we do, the direct design of those things, and then partner the manufacturing. So if you're on the IP side, so we own and we license out, and then we share in the margin that comes out the other end as multiple units are sold. And so this leverages, helps our horticulture industry, leverages Canada's got quite a tremendous, in Ontario, tremendous manufacturing and automation industry. So it leverages the presence of that. And those guys, since 2008, have become very open-minded about what they might work on.
Trait development. So again, how am I doing?
Okay, so traits, we do, you know, and again, genetic engineering is a wonderful thing, but it's from a consumer standpoint, very painful. Regulatory issues are massive and expensive. Patent issues, you know, you get your average vector's got 83, you need 78 to 83 licenses, right, to do that. So you need net present values that are enormous. And for horticulture crops, very difficult, right? We don't have crops, billion, multi-billion dollar crops. They're all this 50, 40, 10, that kind of thing. And so reverse genetics is a mutation-based approach to trait development. And we built a platform for that and are currently busily deploying it in things like petunia, tomatoes, pepper, and cucumbers. Canadian Hardy Rose Breeding Program. So this is an interesting niche for us. I don't know if you've heard, but Canada's kind of cold. And so why not go with it? And so along with the Canadian Nursery Landscape Association, we partnered to bring this program to Vineland. It had been part of the federal government for almost half a century and had been languishing for the previous decade. And so those roses are kind of zone 2 hardy, minus 35-ish, kind of comfortable.
and the program is focused on black spot resistance and a narrow range of colors that consumers want. Of course, red is one of them, and there's a few other opportunities in whites and yellows as well, that and bicolor roses that are quite significant. Breeding vegetables, so there's two pieces to this. Those are sweet potatoes there, but I can talk a little bit with Evans here as well about world crops. We have immigration patterns in Canada that are not really different from yours, but every year we get a 250,000 new Canadians, 80% of whom are either from China or from India, and they bring with them different food traditions. So the strategy of Canadian agriculture so far has been to ignore that. Yet by you know, towns like Toronto, by 2017, you've got 55% of the population is ethnic minorities, and we're trying to teach them to eat turnips, right? And that's a joke, but they don't want them. They just want what they want, so they're just vegetables, right? They're just vegetables. People eat what they know, you know, and save maybe the highlands of New Guinea where they eat who they know. That's a program that we focused on okra, long Asian eggplant, and the round Indian eggplant. Quite significant markets locally, also in the states surrounding us. And we've been busily screening and building production systems and making that happen. So at the end of the day, what are the challenges left in these innovation systems? I'd say for us, it's not really about more money. We all want more money, but the truth is, when I look into our own budget, we have enough. It's about how we innovate. That's the problem, right? That money, feeding the dinosaur, is really expensive, right? And if they're in, you know, I don't know, Einstein, I think, is attributed this saying, but that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Well, that's what we've been doing for a long time. And really, that's the problem. We need to change the way we do it. We need that end point. Say, no, it's got to get out this far. That's why we're here. We need to move faster. And I think, you know, and that sort of reflects back in the core public sector, mainly the federal government, that you have to move at the pace that your clients need you to move. And otherwise, you become irrelevant. And when they come and shut your program down, nobody says anything, because it really wasn't helping anyway. Horticulture, particularly complicated stakeholder engagement and investment. You know, just in edible horticulture in Ontario, about 144 crops. And so that fragmentation creates complexity. Everybody wants to be looked after, and it's all very democratic, and the $800 million business has got as many votes as the $300,000 business, and so that makes it difficult. Getting a grower, particularly grower organizations, it's not so hard with companies, but grower organizations, to invest more money in innovation, to take control of their own future. I mean, most of which, when you ask them, where do you want to be in 10 years, how big should your crop be, who are you going to sell it to, have no idea. They're mostly focused on lobbying, right? So that subsidy programs and that kind of thing. So that fragmented stakeholder base, and as I just mentioned, the old system is very expensive. Innovation is more important in agriculture than we give it credit for, right? Because it keeps us alive. And that we can't afford really to get it wrong. So I think, again, we need to take stock in that, and if we need to change, let's get it done. And that's the story.
You're uniquely positioned beside you have a Guelph across the water, and beside Brock University, which has the genealogical center now for grapes, and you've also got your greenhouse industry down in the corner.
Yep.
Which, and of course, you've got the tremendous U.S. population across the border. We want to ship the vegetables down that way as well. From a legacy standpoint, maybe you still have some connections to Guelph that way.
Yep. No, we had a big relationship.
Uniquely, I can remember back in the day. Some work there with the Laval Group and greenhouses, there wasn't much communication between Ag Canada's greenhouse research division, which was down in the middle of the greenhouse belt, close to Windsor across the border from Detroit.
Yeah.
And the research that they were doing at Guelph, they just were not on the same page. Are you finding that Vineland and where you are now, you are more responsive to the industry needs, and you're working a little more closely on the same page, and maybe even working with Ag Canada as well to put them on the same page?
Right. So the collaboration part of it is it's again project-based. We try to build in whoever we can or should in order to get something done, right? So we don't have all the skills or all the equipment or all the people. So Ag Canada's partners in not necessarily, well, in some of the greenhouse stuff we do in biocontrol, University of Guelph, all over. So we have a deal with, a partnership deal with them. So their portion of the contract that they used to conduct ag research in the province, the pork portion comes to us through them. So, and that brings the staff and a bunch of other stuff that are embedded in our organization. And then the other collaboration, it's just like you say, you've got a project to do, we're open to it. I mean, I would argue that perhaps those traditional organizations, they also compete with us at the same time. So there's this weird kind of passive-aggressive relationship that we have. We work together, but we don't.
How do you get the word out on what you do? How do you reach? You've got a number of people since 2006. You've got a lot of.
Yeah, we're up from one, that was me, to 86 now. So it's a good, reasonable size organization. But we're, you know, we spend a lot of money on marketing and PR. And we just had a big event last night, right? So that's part of it. And then the rest of it is just, you know, why am I here? Because you got to talk to people, and again, you can't get your message out enough. You can't say it enough times. You have to say it over and over and over again.
Is that the same thing true for U of F, for you, Mary? Yeah, for you. Same thing then.
And then the big key is results. What you got to get results, and if you bring prosperity to people and you solve their problems, you're going to be golden. Your reputation will build itself. But when you're a new organization, you know, and I think probably Bioproducts Center is a good example, you got to talk a lot to people about your potential and what you want to do and what you can do and what your capabilities are and why you're different. I mean, when you look at Vineland, we're a brick box. We're like a brick box filled with smart people, right? Are our smart people smarter than your smart people? Well, maybe. But it's really about how you work and the results you deliver. Pardon me?
We're better
at hockey. If we brag too much, we'll end up looking like England in soccer if we're not careful.
Any questions for him or for speak? It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thanks.